And you take values and you turn it into a column and an array. And it's really handy, and there are tricks for doing it. Frankly, I kind of would recommend that if you're going to do reports of SQL, get a report writer. We'll have all kinds of nice options. We'll save you the trouble of writing the code. Basically, just do your queries, pass it over, and the report writer will handle formats and pretty printing and all that, and they're not that expensive. But if you need to, here's some tricks for it. Unfortunately, the code gets kind of bad, so if you do really neat cross-tabs. But I want to know how many employees I have broken down by sex and by race. In fairness, most of the places I've worked, the employees were not so much broken down by sex as it was drugs and alcohol. But okay, I guess if you've got a younger crowd. As I said, it's not relational. I'm taking an attribute and converting the values into columns, effectively. So here's a sex by, it's not particularly easy to see slide, I apologize for that. But here's a sex by race slide, where I've got a number in a grid, and I've got row and column totals. And I've got a full statistical package. I can also do chi-squares and percentages by column, percentages by row, a whole bunch of really nice things that are using meaning. I can also rearrange them. So sex within race, by city within county, all kinds of fancy reports. For a simple one, one way to do it is with subqueries, where I just have a subquery inside the select list and do the counts. Male tally, female tally, a grand tally. Frankly, this is not a good thing. It can be expensive. You mentioned the Postgres optimization for this, but it's still expensive. The other way to do it is essentially with a matrix. Ones and zeros, down with ones down the main diagonal. That's what the department matrix is. I've got something I can use in a multiplication to get the totals. Here's my state matrix, same thing. Ones down the center. So when I want to get the totals within city, within state and department, I can do this as a sum of multiplications. For every two ones come together, I get a result. For every one of them is a zero, it essentially drops out. I get my count of employees within departments, within states. Surprisingly, that's actually quite fast. It's not recommended, but that little diagonal trick can be pretty handy. Spoke to the committee years ago in Rapid City, South Dakota. Rapid City, South Dakota has Mount Rushmore, two strip joints, and a pretty good brew pub, and parking spaces for buses at the hotels for the tourists come to look at Mount Rushmore. That's the only industry in the town. There are three postcards, Mount Rushmore in the morning, Mount Rushmore in the afternoon, and Mount Rushmore at night. But the Sistrap, this is how long it was, had his overhead foils, old stack them, and he did his How I Invented C++, what a little programming is. This is back when it was still fairly new. So after he did his little talk, we asked him about putting OO into the next SQL standard. That time, the working draft was called SQL 3. And he said that at Bell Labs, they had found four ways that they were playing with for doing OO stores. Inside databases. They all stank, and he had come to the conclusion after having some of the best minds on OO in the world at that time, beat on the problem that OO is very nice for programming and not good for data. However, there are ways to fake it. Classic example, I've got a general class. I want subclasses in it, let's say vehicles. Okay, I've got a good universal identifier for vehicles. By the way, anytime you start a project, look for the industry standards. This is another one that drives me nuts with the newbies. They immediately try to invent their own code, or they auto-number everything. To me, auto-numbering things without looking for standard code is like identifying a car by the parking space number that it's in currently, as opposed to looking for the VIN number. That's literally what you're doing in a lot of cases. Okay, I've got a VIN number, so I've got a good standard universal thing for all vehicles. Now, say I want to break it down into two mutually exclusive classes, subclasses.
An airplane is not a vehicle for you.
What?
An airplane is not a vehicle for you?
No, not for VINs.
Well, that's why they don't have VINs.
I think over the airplane.
Bicycles don't have VINs either.
No. In which case they're not a vehicle. It's nice to be able to define things, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be a vehicle, you must have a VIN. Just like to be an object, you must have an OID. Now, anytime somebody talks about OIDs, I keep telling them, God put a 17-letter Hebrew name on the bottom of everything. You just have to turn it over and look. That's the way I feel about OIDs. They're capitalistic magic. I'm a relational guy. We work for natural peace. Okay, I've got two subclasses, SUVs and sedans. I don't know if you've driven around in this country, but you'll probably notice our mania for SUVs. Doesn't matter. You've got one kid, and you've got him in a safety seat, in the back of this thing the size of a tractor trailer truck. It makes no sense. Why do you have a vehicle that looks like it can go through a jungle when you live in a city? But okay, I have a table for my VIN, for my vehicles rather. The VIN becomes my primary key, but I also need to know the different classes that can be logged. In this case, my subclasses, two of them, little three-letter abbreviation. And I know that it's unique, so I don't have an SUV with the same VIN number as a sedan. I'm doing check constraints. Well, overlapping candidate keys are going to be a problem, which is why I want a compound key on this that includes the possible subtypes. My root class, my highest class, is got to be able to represent everybody. Now, in the SUV table, yeah, I have a reference back to that main class, except now my vehicle type and my compound key is hardwired. In the SUV table, everything better be an SUV, nothing else. So I need a foreign key reference, I need some uniqueness constraints, I need to have those wonderful DRI cascade on update and delete. Those almost ought to be as common as not null is when you declare a table. That's another one that's also driving me nuts with newbies. Go to the newsgroups. I look at the number of people wanting to write proprietary trigger code when they've got a product with DRIs. I honestly don't understand it. Other than I know procedural languages, I'm comfortable with procedural code, triggers are procedural code, therefore I will write triggers. The nice part with the declarative reference integrity is it also gives hints to the optimizer. If I've got a primary foreign key relation between two tables, I know something about the existence of a value in the referenced table. It's not child and parent, it's referenced and referencing. Child and parents, an INS term, in the old days of pointer chains and navigational databases, so I'm afraid they have a big deal about that. But I know something just by seeing that there's a foreign key reference. I don't have to look at the table. I don't even have to look at the index on the table. So DRI not only buys me the actions I want, it also sends something to the optimizer to improve my other queries. Also, if I've got some architectures, the value appears only once is a primary key, and its references in the other tables are part of a pointer chain. So when I go to update a value, one of the arguments about using natural keys is that if a natural key changes for some reason, you have to go to all these tables and change it everywhere. No, you got the right architecture, the right implementation. You change it once in one location, the pointer chains go back to that one value. It's actually much faster. Sybase SQL Anywhere, formerly QuantCom SQL, does it that way. What they call a key join. There's some other implementations, but sort of an aside. So I've got my SUV table with all of the protections on it. I now do a sedan table the same way. If I want to get some subclasses, essentially the same architecture. Two-door, four-door sedans. Put those underneath the sedan class with the same thing. We actually built a nice little template for this. And just cut and paste, cut and paste, cut and paste, fill in the names. I do recommend drawing little boxes and arrows chart so you don't get lost. And there's a representation for classes. Okay, after you get this, there's a wonderful thing we have called in setup triggers. It was originally intended for views. Problem with views. If you want to have, a view is supposed to be a virtual table. It's supposed to act like a table. But updatable views are a really serious problem. In fact, Chris Date thought he had solved it a couple of years ago. He now admits that, no, he was wrong. I love it when that happens. Date and I used to write for sister magazines. And anytime he would write a column on one topic, I take the other side out of the next issue in my magazine. And everybody thinks I hate Chris Date. No, it's just a good way to get a topic. So I meet my deadline. No animosity, but no, view updatability is hard. But we have what's called in setup triggers in standard SQL. You put them on a view, and instead of the action being triggered on the view, which you can't, it does something else, which usually means go to the base tables that build the view, modify them in some way, and then it'll show back up in the view. As far as the user is concerned, well, this view has just acted like any other regular table when I did an update or delete from it. It's all hidden. Hopefully the setup trigger is written so that it behaves in a logical way. I don't have to worry about it. In full SQL, it's rather limited as to what you can do directly with an updatable view. So I can continue this pattern all the way down and build my class structures. Put in setup triggers on it, so when I do a join across all of these tables, get my complete SUV table. I don't know that it's really being built from 2, 3, 4, 5, however hairy my class structure is, when I see it. A little awkward. Does it work? Yeah, actually, it's not too bad. But it's, again, using SQL for something it really wasn't meant to do. So, I fully recommend that. Another thing that's underused, I might pull that one out first, by the way, sort of a random thing as opposed to there. Another thing that drives me nuts is DDL is underused. Why? Well, let's go back to procedural language stuff again. How hard is it to write a file description? Any COBOL programmers here? Yeah, okay. Yeah, don't tell mother. She would be so ashamed. Another thing we don't like here, that 78% of the world's programs are still in COBOL. But they have a whole definition section up front of the file structures. Or you bring them in from a copy book in those shops. The file structures are pretty simple. A list of fields, a short description of them. That's about it. And it assumes that they're with contiguous storage in the order they're declared, blah, blah, blah. They're also very language specific. From the old days, horror stories about taking a COBOL file and loading it into a Fortran program or vice versa, and the program didn't notice, so it ran. I think the worst one I ever heard of for a dirty data, you used to have 80 column records. the standard punch card size. There'd be a little header that would identify things. Hospital began most of its records with the patient identification number. And if that was there, everything was fine. So somebody loaded a set of tapes that began with the hospital's patient identification number into a system. Unfortunately, the tape was coming off of an MRI system in 80 column blocks. So it cheerfully filled the patient's records with an MRI scan in all its columns. No other checks. That's a characteristic of files. A file has meaning because of what reads it, not because of anything in itself. A database is different. Things have meaning because they're in the database. The database has the metadata, has the description. File systems don't. I really get annoyed with people on the news group that keep calling a column a field. If you've got that mindset, you're still thinking files and punch cards and that kind of thing, you never really make the leap to being a good SQL programmer.
Well, then the database is still the stupid data container.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Nothing else. Basically, a file system. What's really fun, if you look at the data types that a newbie does, and go to the default values. Let's make everything in varchar 255, or if you're coming in from Access, it's varchar 50. So I've got zip code in varchar 255. Well, guess what? If you do, and this is more for my data quality control, but if you do that, you are going to get a zip code in Chinese, 255 characters long. I know, because when I go to test people's databases, I've got a couple of sutras from my wife in Chinese that are under 255. So at least they will learn some Buddhism while they're debugging. Of course, it's going to mess up the display something awful. But if you didn't want it, don't allow for it. You just don't think of constraints. The thing with constraints, too, is a smart optimizer goes out and pulls those in. He knows his check ranges. He knows his default values. He knows a whole bunch of things about a column in SQL by reading the schema information tables. And those things actually do go in. The nice thing, if they're predicates, is that unlike triggers or stored procedures, you can actually bring the code in. Now, you might not, because they do change, and postal codes change a little bit, but if you want to look at a really hairy standard for something that is universal, IBAN, International Bank Account Number. The specs are about this thick. Basically, it begins with a country code, standard ISO country code, and after that, each country has its own definitions, and its own check digit schemes and everything else. It's essential, and it's a caulking thick standard. There's like 60 different ways of doing bank account numbers. And somehow IBAN actually works, because you probably noticed there is such a thing as international commerce. What was the line about, the drug problem does have an upside. It did something the American school system couldn't do. It taught our children the metric system. That's so much for international commerce. But it is a honking thick standard. There exists some procedural stuff for postal codes that will key on the country code and then apply a subroutine, essentially, to validate it. The thing with postal codes and validating is they change so much. In particular, in the U.S., we've got zip code, which was originally zone improvement program, because we used to have a zone system. It was basically an expansion of the old zone system. The boundaries change depending on population. The zip plus four, the last four digits that are now added on, actually give you the postal carrier routes. So if there's any change, like somebody puts in a bridge or a highway or a building gets knocked down, the routes get redone at the local level. The plus four changes. So they issue regular updates. It has to be done procedurally. Every 6 weeks. Is it 6 weeks? Anybody know? Is it 6 weeks or 8 weeks? I can't remember. I used to do some bulk mailing stuff. But it's every so many weeks, there's a new set of tapes. So, probably the same way in other countries. You know, the city gets bombed out of existence, we've got the postal code. Oopsie. That address no longer exists. Really, no longer exists. But some of that will, some stuff, you know, for all my data-centric view of the world, some stuff really is best done procedurally. You do need to have regular updates to code and that kind of stuff. But anyway, the smart optimizer can use constraints in the execution plan. So the better set of constraints you get, the better results you get.
No longer exists doesn't mean necessarily that you can drop it.
No, that's true. For
yeah, because reasons. You would add something there.
Yeah, and get it back. If you want to get into some really weird stuff, look at secure databases that actively lie to users based on their security clearance. Being on one, did a lot of stuff for naval research on that. So you know, if you're at one level of security and you ask questions, you're told Clark Kent is a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper. If you're at another level, you're told he's Superman. It gets interesting that then how you defend against statistical attacks. Your answers are pretty close, but never exactly right, depending on your security plan. That one gets really weird. But anyway, create table statement, columns and constraints, inside parentheses. The model in SQL is that the schema comes into existence all at once, which means that schema creation time technically ain't have circular references. Oopsie. This is a great way to shoot yourself in the foot.
No.
But then it might be something you actually wanted. You know, that's
why you have to be thorough with us, right?
Yeah. Well, it's that was coming later, but yeah, the current standard, you can declare a constraint as starting, set, or not set. You can defer it during an operation, but the rule is at the end of your operation, all the constraints must be met. And get into the whole issue of constraint databases.